going to introduce our two speakers for in a moment, who are going to give us their introductory thoughts on the wider topic. I think, without setting too negative a tone, it's been fair to say that certainly the last mandate or two haven't been particularly an exercise in great governance, and it has, I think, as our party has said before, its power being divided rather than shared, and really divided out, and the outputs and some of the hope and the optimism that our party and our partners created in 1998 has had something of the life squeezed out of it. And I think nowhere is that more acutely obvious than in voter trends. We have dropped from 81% in 1998 to, I think, 54% at the election last May. And I think that shows how starkly people, the belief that politics can and will change life for the better has fallen. The last mandate alone, governance at all in any form, has ground to a halt twice for periods of deadlock and political logjam. And I think we can still see clearly the DUP and Sinn Féin obsessing about picking the wound of division more than about using those hard-fought institutions to improve things. And I think one of the lessons, in macro lessons in governance and the lessons for our party in particular, is to fight our way out of that intercommunal rivalry that is the Sinn Féin trying to strangle the SDLP and the DUP trying to strangle the Ulster Unionist Party, and to continue to beat our own path in a different direction. But we're very lucky to have two experts in governance to talk about how that will actually look, those concepts that we will use and employ hopefully in the next mandate to try and get more results for the people that we all represent. So I'm delighted Sinead has warmly welcomed and explained to you who Paul is, for those who don't know. But Paul, if you wouldn't mind your remarks. Thank you.
Thank you, Claire. I spent so many years in the Labour Party over the water that I find it very difficult not to start this by saying comrades, but that doesn't seem to be the house style here, so I'll restrain myself just about. What I would say is, when we're talking about good governance, a good starting point is that we talk about the future, not the past. But actually, in Ireland, that seems to be impossible, because the past is the present and therefore it is also the future. But actually, if you don't mind me saying this in a perhaps comradely fashion, I think that's a special warning or lesson for the SDLP, that is essential to think about the future more than about the past. But we can't avoid talking about the past. And last week, I was very touched to be at the launch of this book, Beyond the Silence, which is the story of women's experience in the Troubles. And I'll read a couple of sentences before I say anything else, if you don't mind. This is some words from a daughter of Sammy Deveny, but people may not know. He died after he was beaten up in his own home by RUC officers. And she said recently, "It annoys me that people, politicians, think you can brush things under the carpet. You can't. Too many people here need answers, and that should be a priority. We can't move forward until this is addressed for everybody. It's important to talk about these things now. It's therapeutic. People need to know the real history from those who lived it." And that is true. That is especially true because the past is still the present. And I would suggest that we need to go back to Eames Bradley, because that is the only realistic roadmap that I've seen that deals with the future in terms of dealing with the legacy. And I saw Dennis here earlier. And I do hope that we take that into account. Because somehow Northern Ireland has become locked into a world in which the truth cannot be told. Now, I'm an Englishman who lives over here, and actually one of the things I want to know more than anything else is what my government did in my name in terms of murders and collusion with murders. And I am not happy that I do not know that. And I'm sure that no one in Northern Ireland and no one in this room will be unhappy. Equally, we need to know what happened with the Kinkora child abuse scandal and the role of the security forces in that scandal as well. But is it any better today? If you look, as Claire has referred, to the things about NAMA and the Project Eagle scandal, what do we actually know about the transactions, how they were conducted? What do we know about Red Sky's contracting with the housing executive? It feels bad. And come to that, what do we know about MLA's constituency office expenses or party funding? Now, political and economic decisions are taken away from public sight, and that was absolutely clear with Nama. But I'll tell you something about my own history. I was a councillor in Leicester, and I was certain that there was a group of councillors that were taking money, they were taking bribes. I went to see the treasurer about that, and I said, what can we do about it? And he said, well, I have a simple rule, which is I look at how much legitimate earning someone has, and I look at their lifestyle, I look at how much they're spending, I look at the assets that they own. And if there's a mismatch, then I know there's something wrong. And actually, we should take the same view when we're looking at the lifestyle of our MLAs. Now, in the London mayor election, the mayor election candidates are declaring their income. They're showing their income tax returns. If it's good enough for the mayor of London, surely it's good enough for the MLAs here. There's far too much that smells bad at Stormont. So let us move from simply being in a bad position to actually be better than the rest. We shouldn't try simply to ape the system at Westminster, which itself does not smell good. We need to be better. We need to have a system of proper transparency in terms of finance and decision making. If I were writing the SDLP manifesto, I would put the demand for political transparency at the very heart of this. Now, in Scotland, in the last few days, campaigners have won an important victory. They've got new legislation which gives transparency on lobbying. That we should copy. The OECD, an international think tank of good governance, recently said, a few days ago in fact, the disclosure of party funding and campaign donations must be in the public arena. They said policy making should not be for sale to the highest bidder. I'd also point out that contracts should not be on sale to people who've got internal influence and improper relationships with any party. The awarding of contracting must be open and above board. The current systems do not work. But equally, if we do not have an effective opposition in government, you will not have accountability. As far as I'm concerned, the foundations of democracy are honesty, transparency, and accountability. On all three measures, Northern Ireland fails today. A party that is committed to those three principles may or may not win power, but at least it deserves to win power. But I'll say a few other words, if I may, which is that what we need to do is to create a modern state that contains modern political parties, ones that look forward, not back. We need to move, as Claire has said, beyond the sectarianized state. We need to have people that are prepared to make brave and honest decisions. I do not believe there's a single politician in Stormont that believes actually the structure of public service delivery in Northern Ireland is what should be delivered today, whether it's efficient or effective for the citizens of Northern Ireland. So we need to actually be honest and say what needs to be done to reform health, what needs to be done to reform social housing, what needs to be done to reform the school system, what needs to be done in higher education. We have far too many easy comments that actually represent real-term lies within Stormont. We need to move towards a system that is socially liberal. And can I say this in a gesture of friendship? In my opinion, the SDLP is at a crossroads. The SDLP needs to decide if it's a movement of progressive social democracy or whether it's the political wing of the Catholic Church. It has to make that decision in order to move forward. What Northern Ireland needs now is a movement of progressive social democracy. And that is one way in which we will hopefully have a social democratic government within Stormont, but at the very least, a system of proper accountability. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Paul. Some very useful and indeed challenging thoughts for the SDLP there, but we've always been open to challenge. Thank you very much, and we'll pick up on the conversation. But for now, I'm delighted to invite Cathy to make her remarks.
Okay, conciseness is not really my strong point. Usually on The View or in Sunday Politics, Mark Crothers raises his eyebrows like this as I keep talking. So I was told I had 5 minutes, so this is actually quite concise and I'm happy to take a lot of questions afterwards. I started with a very basic question. How do we deliver better government for all, if that's what we intend to do. And like Paul, honesty, transparency and accountability lie at the heart of my remarks. But I'm starting in reverse. I'm going to tell you exactly what I think should be proposed, and it might be something that the party would consider as part of their manifesto going forward. So in terms of accountability, I have an example to share with you. In 2000, Belgium, also a consociational democracy like ourselves, added what was called an annual accountability day to its parliamentary calendar. Now, what that is a day of debate in which the government's performance across the year is scrutinised. It's high profile, attracts a lot of media attention, and even the term, the annual accountability day, sends a very clear message that we as an electorate have a right to expect to hold our government to account. So that's my first suggestion. The second one is in terms of transparency. If you look at organisations like Transparency International and so on, the UK as a whole is regarded as one of the most transparent systems of government, particularly through things like the use of open government data. Now, in any well-functioning democracy, citizens do need to know what it is that their governments are actually doing. And to do that, you have to be able to freely access government data and information, and you have to be able to share that information with other people. So transparency is not just about access to data. It's also about how it's shared and how it's reused. And often to understand a lot of this material, it has to be analysed and visualised in a way that we sometimes see now, these infographics which show us and explain things to us in a very visual way, which captures the imagination much more than a spreadsheet with lots of percentages stuttered across it. So the Northern Ireland Assembly, in this spirit of open government data, decided that the quickest and easiest way to make data available on the internet was to publish all of its data in raw form as an XML file. Now, I have gone in and looked at the open government data that the Northern Ireland Assembly has put out there in the interests of transparency for all citizens to be able to access, but also to be able to reuse. And I'm a social scientist and I can't make head nor tail of it. Now, I am a qualitative social scientist, so statistics is not my strong point, but certainly it's something that Paul and I can pick up on later. The data is only as useful as the person who's interrogating it. It is there, but I have seen very little evidence of any civil society organisations, academics, journalists and so on actually taking that data from the Assembly now and using it to good effect. So that's my second challenge and suggestion that I'll put forward today. And the third one is in relation to the issue of engagement. There's a challenge for smaller parties like the SDLP in terms of the visibility that you have around delivering better government for all. And it's more important than ever for a small party to play its part in terms of its submissions, its suggestions, its engagement with the committee structures. And I'm thinking particularly of the Assembly and the Executive Review Committee, which in my view is one of the key committees that helps make sure that the way in which we deliver government is fit for purpose. I'm sure I'm preaching to the choir here when I tell you that the number of Assembly and Executive Review Committee reviews that have taken place over the last number of years have been considerable. We had the 2012 review of the number of members that there should be in the Legislative Assembly. Most recently, this month and last month, we had the report from the Assembly and Executive Review Committee on John McAllister's private members bill. And it's at this point that I come back to the issue of engagement for smaller parties in the Assembly. That's a really influential private members bill that got a lot of the clauses that it wanted through, including the clause that the person holding the chair of the Public Accounts Committee in the Assembly should not belong to the larger parties. That convention would suggest that in keeping with Scotland and Wales, it goes to the opposition. And if, like Scotland and Wales, there is no official opposition, it goes to one of the smaller parties, non-governing parties, as they're referred to. But in my research on the Assembly and Executive Review Committee, I noticed that the SDLP was largely absent. So when I talk about engagement, and in terms of engagement for delivering better government for all, I would have wanted to see a party such as yours have much more engagement with that private member's bill, put your stamp on it in terms of what you see are the important attributes of opposition in whatever way this political party sees that as being defined, whether it's opposition with a capital O, opposition with a small o, or parties not in government as opposed to an official opposition. And that wasn't there to the extent that I would have liked to see it. So there are my three suggestions in terms of accountability, transparency, and engagement. But when you consider these three things, I would argue that they have to be considered in the context of multi-level governance in Northern Ireland. This is about much more than the Assembly, and we tend to take, and the media commentators, all of us, tend to take a very reductionist approach to governance in Northern Ireland, and we focus only on the devolved institutions. We have to begin to use the language of multi-level governance because that is our reality when it comes to accountability, transparency, and engagement. That multi-level governance includes holding to account what happens at Westminster, in the NIO, the Joint Ministerial Council, and that whole level, national level governance. For example, where's the parliamentary scrutiny of the intergovernmental relations that we signed up to in 1998 as part of the Good Friday Agreement? It's severely lacking. How many of you know here what exactly happens in the joint ministerial committees, which were established as a consequence of devolution? I would guess very few of you know. I certainly don't, because the minutes and the publicly available information about what actually happens at the JMC is negligible. How often do our ministers on the floor of the Assembly make statements on their activities and engagements through the North-South Ministerial Council and through the British-Irish Council? Indeed, there are a whole gamut of East-West channels through which Britain and Ireland have complicated relations, including the British-Irish Intergovernmental Conference, the British-Irish Interparliamentary Body, the British-Irish Interparliamentary Assembly, and this spaghetti hoop or spaghetti soup of intergovernmental agencies and actors have confused, more than clarified, the nature and the extent of the relationships that we have that help make better government for all. It's not just at the level of the devolved institutions. So I would argue that the North-South bodies still lack accountability and oversight. There's barely any questions on the floor of the Assembly asked of our ministers about what happened. Just vague communiques published afterwards and put on a website, and neither the media nor the MLAs tend to pick up on them. I want to finish with an example of poor government from my perspective, and again, I'm sure I'm preaching to the choir, when we were entitled to better government last September with the repeated resignations of DUP ministers in response to the political crisis at that time. My view at the time, when asked what would happen if the DUP appointed ministers and then resign immediately afterwards ad infinitum every 6 days. My view at the time when I was asked was that this would put them in breach of the revised ministerial code from St Andrews. The revised ministerial code was revised to address concerns that ministers had neither properly nor fully engaged with the work of the executive and therefore had undermined the collective and accountability requirements of their posts. So the St Andrews Agreement introduced a new statutory ministerial code and also revised the existing pledge of office. And I would encourage people to read that again, because in my view, when anyone thinks that our government and our governance is not up to standard, my suggestion is to use the toolkit that we have, and that ministerial code of conduct and the pledge of office is there for a reason. It's to hold our government and our ministers to account. And when I read it carefully, it was then and is still my view that it was a breach of the ministerial code of conduct, and I would have expected more people to use that as a rationale for what needed to follow in the days, weeks and months afterwards from September until December when we finally had another agreement. Again, there's a suite of tools that can be used to highlight failings in governance beyond audit committees and commissions and so on, and I would urge everyone to use those to its fullest effect. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much indeed, Cathy, and that was certainly provoking in the correct way as well, and I'm sure we'll touch on it later. There are probably underused accountability mechanisms, but I must say even some of those that you've outlined, we do attempt, when the NAMA scandal was emerging, we attempted first of all to recall the Assembly to discuss it, to get a handle on it, and that was 8 or 9 months ago, and I know I have, and I'm sure very many other members have unanswered questions, literally questions that we've tabled to ministers as written and oral questions that haven't been answered, and indeed when there are clear breaches of the ministerial code, the petition of concern has been used to protect those guilty of those infractions. So it's a circle and a cycle of changes to those procedures that we need. Well, listen, we've got about 20, 25 minutes for a bit of a chat to get more of these ideas out of our panellists. Mark, I just wanted to see if you had any initial responses to Paul and Cathy that you can repeat, that we can repeat.
No, I take all the points as well made. I would agree with many of them. Some of them are points that I and the party have tried to make in the past at different times. I think the whole point about transparency and the emphasis Paul put on that, I think, is more important than many of us in politics actually realise. Because transparency isn't just a matter of calling people to account when you know something has been done wrong. Transparency is about making sure that people are absolutely scrupulously conscious that in taking decisions, they are dealing with public affairs, they're dealing with public money, and they're meant to have charge of the public interest. And they're meant to know why they're taking the decisions that they're taking. They're also meant to know why the people who are presenting them with options have presented them with the particularly limited options that they sometimes present them with. And how often do we find that, you know, it's maybe the result of a Freedom of Information request, maybe by somebody in the media, maybe by a lobby group, that actually puts a different backlight on a policy issue than maybe we, the politicians, have been talking about before. So information often changes the issue. And certainly it can change the politics and the priority around the issue. So that's why transparency is so important there. And that's real public transparency, not just within the beltway of the political system. It's also, I think, to try to make sure then too, if we are talking about transparency, to make sure that it is more joined up. We talk a lot about joined up government. We don't have a lot of joined up scrutiny. And in fact, we have less scrutiny now in the Assembly than we were meant to have. Whenever we wrote the agreement and wrote the section that gave the committees this seemingly powerful brief, we didn't really think we were going to end up with committees that ended up being jacks of all trades and master of none in terms of the different powers that they have, because they have become a bit chummy with the departments. Officials know they're going before committees that they're very familiar with. They can nearly predict which member is going to ask which question. In fact, the briefing they come with already has in the pre-programmed flattery lines to particular members to acknowledge their interest in a given area or whatever. There's not as much scrutiny as we should see at that level. I think ways in which I'm improving that are which is the committee that civil servants do fear going in front of. It's the Public Accounts Committee, because that is more free range. It can take across ways. So we need to do some more cross-cutting committees like that. So one that maybe looks at capital expenditure, that just regularly interrogates what the different departments and non-departmental government bodies are dealing with capital expenditure, not just the big projects, but even things like maintenance budgets, where money still ends up getting handed in at the end of the year or ending up being spent in a suboptimal way just before the end of the year or whatever. But that's the sort of thing. Cathy mentioned John McAllister's bill. One of the good things in John McAllister's bill was the idea of actually a budget committee, because I think the Assembly scrutiny of the budget isn't what it should be, and DFP, the kind of structures that we negotiated, don't work as well as we maybe planned and hoped they would. And of course, over recent years, we have seen the Assembly's budget role filleted. I mean, Peter Robinson got away with an absolute lie when, in a huff After our challenge with amendments to the budget that he tabled in 2008 as finance minister, and we tried amending the budget and we tried amending the programme for government, in a huff at that scrutiny and challenge where we ended up voting against the budget, he then came up with this pronouncement that he, as Minister of Finance and Personnel, had legal advice that there didn't need to be a draft budget process tabled for 2009 or 2010 because the 2008 budget had figures in it, indicative figures for 9 and 10, and therefore that discharged the requirement in law that there had to be scrutiny in the Assembly of the draft budget for each year. It was a complete lie. I went as party leader to the Assembly Speaker to say this is wrong, the Assembly's role has been carved out here. Any reading of the 98 Act is clear. It should be a full annual budget exercise, just as with multi-annual figures, there's still an annual budget exercise in Westminster. It seemed clear enough to me at the time that there seemed to be legal advice to officials in the Speaker's office that rhymed with my version of things, but no move was made. It was left, if you want to take a legal challenge, you can. And now, of course, we have a bill going through Westminster on foot of the Fresh Start Agreement, which, lo and behold, confirms that Peter Robinson lied and that Nigel Dodds got away with living out that lie when, as Finance Minister, he didn't have proper scrutiny of the budgets in subsequent years, because now, in the name of transparency, there has to be a statement about what the Barnett formula sum is before the draft budget, and people have to stick to that. But when we've recovered that bit of transparency, there needs to be much, much more. And the Assembly is the key to that. And we can have the debate about government or opposition. The Assembly needs to perform much more of its scrutiny and challenge role, and it needs to be allowed to do it by MLAs, whether they have colleagues who are in government or not.
Thank you very much, Mark. With all this talk about transparency and accountability, I have a few questions, but I'd prefer to open it to the floor. If anybody does have a question, put their hand up. If you could just very briefly introduce yourself and ask your questions, and as far as possible, we will keep them to questions rather than statements. Yes, please, sir, just in the second row. Thanks. And I'm going to take two anyway, and possibly three. So if anybody else wants to indicate.
Carlos Adina Uslow's carjet has a gog of manum on case misha. It's being young no gigan a ra a real test and he's far for honey gardenia. I question the word all in this resolution. What does it refer to on the island? When it comes to Ireland, the word all is a puzzle for a federalist, as I am. For a federalist, all means all of the island, to include the people of Kerry as well as the people of Derry. One suspects that the word all in this motion means all for the statelet of Northern Ireland and stops at the border. I published a letter recently in the Belfast Telegraph, which the editor titled...
I am just going to ask you to come to your question fairly quickly, because we are tight in time, and I think federalism is one possible governance model, and I think we'll touch on maybe some of the things we need to do to integrate the two governance, but I do just want to come to your question fairly quickly so that we can involve more participants.
I published a letter recently in the Belfast Telegraph, which the editor titled, We Need a New Ireland. Now, I have other points developed there, but I'll put the question to the panel, what do they mean by a new Ireland?
Thank you. I think that's a very good question, and hopefully one that we'll explore over the course of today as well. I see another hand behind there, Mr. Lyons.
Thanks, Chair. Just very briefly, I mean, some of us have great fun with the Freedom of Information mechanism and sort of playing dances with various public authorities and so forth, trying to get information out. What did the panel think about achieving a balance between having an open, accountable, transparent government, but perhaps, you know, some of the excuses that are quite often used by civil servants to deny the publication of information?
Okay, I'm going to take those two for a start. So briefly, I suppose, at a top line, what are the governance challenges for those of us who are advocates for a united Ireland and more closely aligning the governance infrastructure of those? And Donal's question about freedom of information. And you might touch on as well, Cathy, you talked about the use of data and open data, and I think that is growing. I think we probably need to look to the under-20s in the room who seem to know everything about big data and how to use it. Specifically, Cathy, if you could touch on how that can be maybe used more effectively and how we get around the issue that it might be used for profit making and I suppose for corporates more than maybe for better governance. So I know those are three very big issues, so pick out what you will or you won't. Cathy, do you want to start?
Okay, I'll just pick out on the first part of your question, sir, about what do you mean by all, and I think that was reflected in some of my remarks when I pointed out that they're very rarely are statements or questions asked on the floor of the Assembly about the North-South Ministerial Committees and about the sectoral engagement on the North-South bodies. So all in that context does mean all in the island of Ireland, but those questions have to be asked both in the Dáil and also in the Northern Ireland Assembly, and it is not happening. There is a paucity of information about what benefits the governance north-south arrangements bring to people north and south in terms of those institutions. They were an integral part of the Good Friday Agreement, and they are punching far below their weight in terms of the public information that is out there about them and the scrutiny of what happens within them.
Paul? The situation in terms of governance in Northern Ireland is absolutely disgraceful and scandalous, and I don't know the extent to which people actually understand the scale of the failure. For example, regularly Assembly questions to the First Minister and Deputy First Minister are not properly answered. Secondly, written questions are often ignored. Thirdly, freedom of information requests are quite often either ignored or fail to be met within the statutory time. There is an absolute failure of good structural governance within Northern Ireland. And you move beyond that, and I think what we can see from NAMA is the fact that, I don't know how to say this without potentially getting myself into lots of legal problems, so I have to say not quite what I mean, and then you have to read into it. When you look at NAMA, and when you look at the situation with the Presbyterian Mutual Society, then I am not persuaded that everything has been done in terms of a compliance with the criminal law. And I don't know why. A lot of things, and we live in Derry, and I don't know why people accept what we accept in Northern Ireland. The situation is completely unacceptable, yet we accept it. So, you know, we need to fundamentally challenge the system and have the confidence to challenge the system.
I acknowledged the point about the power of freedom of information, and it is important that we fully protect the practice of that. And yes, all sorts of excusery is tried on by government at times. And I can remember a number way back when the institutions were suspended, there was a period where we were trying to question some of the things, the decisions that were then been made, and I think it was Sean Farn put in some freedom of information requests about some decisions that were made, and so we had this bizarre thing of direct rule ministers answering us that they weren't going to give the answer because they wanted to protect the privacy of negotiations with political parties, and they also wanted to protect their negotiations with the Irish government as well. So given that we were meant to be participants in what was meant to be an inclusive negotiating process, you had that sort of excuse being used, but they got away with it. In terms of the, Michael's question about all should mean whatever level or institution of government, everybody whom that is meant to be served. So if it's an institution in the north, it's everybody in the north. If it's a north-south institution, it should be everybody on the island. If it's an east-west or British-Irish institution, it should be everybody on these islands. And I think we as a party need to be as active in our pursuit about good ideas for sensible east-west and British-Irish cooperation as we are about north-south cooperation. Because when we consider some of the issues that people in this party are passionate about, such as, there's the issues going through in across the water at the minute about what's going to succeed the Cancer Drugs Fund there. There's a whole question about why did we never have our own version of the Cancer Drugs Fund here. But there are issues and choices there of saying, well, there are also some levels of cancer drug interventions, particularly in the diagnostics area. Maybe that should be done on a UK-wide basis, or better still, that should be done on a British-Irish basis with some common funding pools there, some common platforms, and in terms of commissioning some of the research in terms of some of the more innovative drugs and questions of trials or whatever. So we should be looking at things at all levels. So all should mean whatever best suits in a given policy area. So sometimes that will mean at a local government level here. Other times it will mean specific to the north. Other times north, south, and east, west. But it is criminal that our north-south structures have gone undeveloped in the last two assembly terms. The DUP got away with the St Andrews agreement, which set up a review, which was meant to look at the cost effectiveness of existing bodies. Then in the name, we were told at the time that review would also look at new areas of cooperation. Nothing has ever come forward. Nothing has ever emerged. Reports were never even published from that. So when we talk about transparency, reports weren't even published from that, and we have had a stay low, go slow agenda in terms of North-South ever since, and it is an absolute disgrace.
Thank you very much. I'm going to take questions from Eamon, and were there some other hands up as well? Connor and Jim, first of all, and Rosemary, but just brief questions in that order.
Yeah, thanks, Claire. Never agreed with Paul that much, but I think he's probably said all I wanted to say. But I'm going to take the question back into the question of government for all. Is that for all involved in politics in some way or other, or is it for all in terms of the general public? Because I think why they get away with it, Paul, is that the general public, it's not that they don't realise what's happening. They've actually turned off and they don't have the trust. So my question is, how do our politicians start to rebuild trust in the public in what they're doing?
Good question. Connor?
I'm just wondering, the Assembly has just voted to reduce the number of MLAs per constituency from 6 to 5, so I'm just wondering of those challenges of transparency, accountability and challenge, is that situation improved or disimproved by the reduction of MLAs per constituency?
Great. I am just to get them in, I'm going to take Jim and Rosemary as well, just as, if that's okay, folks. Yeah, thank you.
And Mr. Gosling, Jim O'Hagan from Finnehy Branch. I'd like you to please clarify your reference to the SDLP and our links. You seem to be implying we had links to the Catholic Church there. So I'd like you to clarify that, if you would, please. Thank you very
Jim.
Much.
And Rosemary, did you? Yeah. Yes, I will. I'll definitely take the question first. And if we have time, we'll come back to the statement, but we mightn't, because we are quite tight. Thanks.
Okay, I agree with everything you said there. My question is, when you knock at a door, and too frequently we get a blank stare, in a dozen words, what should we say to people at the door that will get them to talk?
Well, I actually didn't know we had constituency organisations that were knocking at doors too frequently, so that's reassuring in the first place that we're having that problem at all. There was a lot there, folks. Do you want to... I'll go in a different order, Paul, if you would pick up on some of those comments. And I suppose Jim's as well, because it was directly to you and it's useful, but we are going to keep trying in the discussion on governance that we're having. But just
yeah, sure. In terms of this, my comment about the whether the SDLP is perceived as the political wing of the Catholic Church, the South has made enormous progress in recent years with the vote, in particular on gay rights and equality of marriage legislation. And the SDLP has also been at the forefront, having changed its position, is at the forefront now of gay marriage equality. And I applaud that. But you have to recognise, I think, that the SDLP is not the party today it was when it was formed, when it was cross-community. And I question the extent to which the SDLP is today cross-community. And so a member of the SDLP, a fairly senior member of the SDLP, said to me a few months ago that he didn't know what people on the left of the political spectrum did if they were Protestant, who they voted for. And that, I think, is a question that you, as members of the SDLP, have to deal with. Because it is difficult when a party is perceived to be so close to the Catholic Church. And I particularly point to the issue of women's reproductive rights.
Is there any of the other issues you want to pick up on as well? Nope. Okay, Kathy. Yep, some of them. I've forgotten. There were some very good questions, okay, but I'm sure you...
I'll pick up on the question about the reduction in the number of MLAs. And whether or not that's better for transparency, that was the question, yeah. In 2012, when the Assembly and Executive Review Committee looked at the number of MLAs in terms of the Legislative Assembly here, the SDLP only made a verbal submission to the review through its party representative that was on the committee at one of the committee meetings. It was the only political party that did not make a written submission out of all of the parties and a number of other external stakeholders in terms of that particular question. So in a sense, that's for the SDLP to decide whether or not their position is it would enhance transparency or reduce transparency having an altered number of representatives. My instinct would be that because of the number of committees that we do have and the number of MLAs that have to sit on more than one committee, most MLAs have to sit on two, a number sit on three and four, you're spread very thin across the committee structure, and the scrutiny role that you have as a member of a committee is obviously going to be diluted if you're on more committees, and that's only going to set to increase with a reduction in the number of MLAs going forward.
Can I add a point to that?
Yes. Specifically, Claire, which is that I think Mark and it's absolutely right also, Mark and Cathy, because scrutiny committees on local government in England have more power and more effectiveness than actually the scrutiny function within Stormont. And when you have effectively the Sinn Féin and the DUP making sort of mock criticisms of each other, that's not a real effective scrutiny. You have to have a different system. And I think it goes back to Cathy's point. You need to have chairs in particular, but membership, which is not basically pulled into this conflict of interest and are able to be can fulfil a genuine scrutiny role.
Well, just to reinforce what Paul has said in terms of the scrutiny issue, I mean, we have a problem in that we have now, it seems now, we've adopted a sort of a boss hog attitude to devolution, that you can be in and you're in charge and that's okay, it's whatever you want and you get your way and whatever you square with somebody else and that's enough. It's important that if you're a minister and you're meant to be serving the public interest, you will be given options at times by officials. Those will be limited options in a deliberate way and all the rest. It is often important for you as a minister to be able to rely on the fact that anything you decide has to be justifiable and has to be able to cope with exposure of all of the details. So it's important to actually say, you know, ministers who are worth their salt should actually want scrutiny, because scrutiny means holds them to a better standard and actually means that they can hold officials who are advising them and expert groups who come to them to a better standard as well. So we shouldn't just see scrutiny just always in the form of the negative challenge. It's the assurance around proper public standards. In terms of some of the other issues, in terms of the size of the Assembly, our original negotiating position for the Good Friday Agreement was 5 seats. And we had put that in previous submissions. We had put that in previous talks. We were tired putting it in talks, whether it was Leeds Castle or anywhere else, about dealing with the size of the Assembly, dealing with the need for far more scrutiny and transparency. I can remember at Leeds Castle, whenever the DUP were going on about, oh, and we need more transparency in the institutions, we said, yes, have every government minister, after the annual budget is decided, have every government minister make their own budget statement as to what they were doing with their spending plans in the Assembly. They have to actually publish and take the hour of questions and do it and stand it up. And Peter Robbins said, no, we don't want that much transparency. That would be too much accountability. But that's why we then ended up with situations like a few years ago after the 2011 budget. Conor Murphy, while he was still the DRD minister, took the decision to suspend the work that was planned for the Derry-Coleraine railway line. But when did that information become public? It became public via a leak that the Into the West group got during the summer, whenever there was a new minister, and everybody in Derry was blaming Danny Kennedy for a decision that had actually been taken by Conor Murphy, because he was able to take that decision in secret and never had to stand it up in front of the Assembly, who are meant to be the budget authority. So we need more by way of scrutiny. It needs to be more joined up, and even a smaller Assembly can do that. But we also need to remember that the current executive, a number of years ago, cut the research budget for the Assembly itself. So the Assembly's research capacity was cut, and in terms of the research capacity for committees, that was cut. So if we are going to cut members, and if members' allowances for support staff is also going to be cut, then the research capacity for the Assembly and its committees needs to be looked at again.
Now, because I'm, yes, the eyebrow raising that you said, the Mark Brothers, I'm getting it from both Ronan and Catherine. We unfortunately don't have time, because I had some. Okay, very, very short. Rosemary.
On good governance, but I think it's up to all of us to challenge all our representatives and all bodies in that respect. But I also reject your implication, Claire, that it's only young people who can access, understand, and deal with data.
And that's a fair point. Well, it was a throwaway comment, because I was at a coder dojo when 14 and 15-year-olds were performing backflips with data, and personally I could manage it, but certainly it wasn't meant to be an exclusionary comment in any way. And just to pick up on a couple of other things, I think it would be remiss not to point out that, you know, it was our party who pushed through the Assembly the need for an institutional abuse inquiry that is now underway, and I don't think we have been lacking in terms of speaking truth to power, wherever it come from, and I think some of the positions held come from wider civil rights motivation. So I think that is worth saying. It's also worth saying in terms of the number of MLAs, that is still up for grabs for Northern Ireland, depending on how many registrations are made. So that's something to all members get out, get more people in the electoral register, and we might have 17 or 18 times 5 instead of 16 or 17. Well, I just wanted to wrap up and pick up on a few of the points, and I think you know, we have picked up on a few of them. It hasn't been a great period of governance. We've been introduced to some concepts around accountability and good governance. I will leave you all to mark your own scorecards on how the executive has performed against those in the last 9 years, but you don't even, I was thinking on the way up, you don't have to go back the last 9 years, just in the last month, some of the scandalous feelings really of governance around the fact that at the start of the week we had spotlight shining a light on the continuing paramilitary infrastructure that were murder machines and now increasingly our political machines, and how parties were willing to throw out a lot of the rules to acquire funding for some of those groups at the same time, the same day, in fact, that we were announcing cuts to, for example, special needs provision for nursery. So I think some of those, the party has asked some hard questions around social investment fund and some of those other projects from OFM, DFM. I think Mark has touched on the issue, the fact that in many cases Stormont as a parliament is being bypassed. I think, sadly, Stormont Castle increasingly is the seat of power. That's where the deals are done, that's where the decisions are made, and they're presented on a plate to other parties, which for parties who talk a lot about mandate, does ignore the mandate and the votes of the 40+% of the population that didn't vote for the two largest parties. And Stormont Castle and OFM, DFM, I think anybody who's watching do know that those have become, OFM, DFM has become the place where ideas go to die. There have been so many inputs and so few outputs, and just the strategy. I know I chair the All-Party Group in International Development, and in my previous role since 2008, we've been seeking an international development strategy from that body, the strategy on sexual orientation, on childcare, and many other things. And it has also been the lead on projects like the Maze that just have built up massive bills and built absolutely nothing for the future. And I think some of the other tremendous failures of governance around the 11 plus, I think, is the most acutely felt by many families, that these top quality negotiators that we have who want to go in and rewrite the Good Friday Agreement and so on, but can't put some of that negotiating prowess to to good use to stop young people having to now embark on a sectarianised and privatised version of an already poor system. Naama, I think we can't but touch on that and the evolving disaster in terms of public confidence in these institutions. The party has been very consistent throughout. We attempted to recall the Assembly when the allegations first began to emerge and have tried to use whatever tools available to us to get answers on that, but those questions aren't being answered, and I think it's fair to say that in this respect sunlight is the finest disinfectant, and we will continue to call for really a fully independent commission of inquiry that can audit some of the individuals involved and the connections that they had outside and inside of government as well. And I think it is worth noting, colleagues, in a time where there is increasing scrutiny, I resent some of the anti-politics campaigns around donor transparency, but people are cynical about who is pulling the strings, and I think for a party like ours that has committed itself to openness, that's an issue that we should get out in front of. We can be open about where we're getting our money, and I think it will decrease some of the cynicism that people have about politics. And I think that's one of the things, I don't want to end on too negative a note, a short rundown on the disaster of the last 4 or 5 and 9 years, but I think going forward it's fair to say our party will campaign to get a strong mandate to get back in using some of the renewed structures, and we did cooperate and work very well with John McAllister to create at least in some form a place called opposition that has removed some of the ugly scaffolding, to quote Mark Durgan, but has left in place those fundamental protections that we negotiated hard to have. We proposed comprehensive reform of the petition of concern as a governance mechanism that will again revert to being a tool that protects the rights of minorities and doesn't thwart them as it has been used to do in recent months. Our budgetary proposals, some of them are through the back door going to be taken on board, and Mark outlined how an annual budgetary process, like every other parliament on these islands has, is appropriate for Northern Ireland instead of the strung together, stitched together series of estimates and reviews and supplements that doesn't allow proper scrutiny of what is going to be spent. And opposition parties like our own can only look at the bulges and the estimates. But fundamentally, we're a party that believes in power sharing, believes in transparency, believes in accountability. We believe in not poking our government partners in the eye, and I think that's going to be a big part of accountability as well, building up that trust and cooperation that we all anticipated in 1998. Just to finish on a few important points to pick up from Michael about unity, we do need to, as those of us who are persuaders for unity, need to explain how that will work, and the biggest challenge of governance is to integrate basically our economy, which is one of the most closed in Europe, and the Republic's, which is one of the most open, and I think that is the real partition in economic terms. Remaining in Europe is going to be part of that, and I think we need to call out Sinn Féin for attempting to poison with green and orange politics the Brexit debate by trying to lead it into a position where it would be a border poll as well. There has been a constructive debate around Europe and what it means for our communities. So I'll finish up on that. Those eyebrows are waggling very firmly. We kept under our hour. We did start late. But thank you very much, and thanks to our panel for all their insights.